You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I think you guys are going to love this one. We welcome Nicholas Epley back to the podcast. Nick is the John Templeton Keller Distinguished Service Professor of Behavioral Science and Director of the Roman Family Center for Decision Research at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. We talked to Nick many moons ago about his fantastic book, Mindwise, and he has a new book. It's called A Little More Social, How Small Choices Create Unexpected Happiness, Health, and Connection. You're going to enjoy this pod. Nick Epley, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Kelly. It's great to be talking to you here.
This is kind of a long first question, but I want to set it up well.
Okay.
You'll see where I'm going with this. So my wife, Ann Libra, was tasked with directing the latest show at Second City, and she was asked to do something a bit different, which was to anchor the show on more improvisation than we would normally do in one of our standard review shows at Second City. So she developed a frame for the production that takes up about the first 20 minutes of the show. She has each actor reveal something unusual about themselves and then in turn ask the audience if they have something unusual in their life that they want to share. Just in the last few weeks, we've had people tell us about dead bodies found in their parents' backyard. There was an uncle who quit being a doctor because he wanted to pursue doing magic, and his magic all had creepy sexual subtext. And we had a woman who had four kidneys. For audience members who don't know, Anne worked with you for a few years on a program called the Second Science Project, which looked at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation and vice versa. Hearing this, can you tell our audience how the stage experiment was influenced by the work you study?
So I think it was influenced by asking people to reveal meaningful things about themselves. That's the that's the part that seems crystal clear to me, that we find in our work in lots of different ways, that when we open up with other people and we reach out to connect with them in positive ways, that it tends to go better than we expect. But that pessimism that keeps us from being open and revealing things to other people that might actually connect us meaningfully with them then means that we're not sharing these meaningful things with other people as often as we could for our own well-being, right? And my bet is that in that stage experiment, people leave that feeling better connected to each other than they would have otherwise. Even if they're sharing kind of unusual, odd things, they feel a little bit better known by other people around them, and feel like they know each other a little bit better. And that's a good thing.
And what's interesting is in the process, she would ask me to come in and give notes to her on the show. And I came one night and it was good. But I realized that the cast themselves had stopped, or at least for that night, hadn't done the self-disclosure first.
Oh, yeah.
And it limited the response. And so she went back. That's when she went back and sort of said, this is actually based on a thing. So, and they've continued to do that. And it just creates a different room in the moment, certainly. But to your point, when you're leaving as well, because you all created the show together. You made these discoveries, and this is strangers, which is also your work as well. And one of the things that I love about your work, and as it appears in the book, is so much of your laboratory is public transportation in Chicago.
Where is that?
And it feels absurd, right? Like, can you imagine when you moved here being like, oh, by the way, this is where you're going to be doing your work?
So I will tell you, there have been a number of occasions where I've planned to run some of the most impactful research that I've ever done. And other people have told me, that's just a really bad idea. You shouldn't do that. Like, mm-hmm. that's just like, why would you do that? The one that you referred to, the most obvious one, is when I tried to figure out, why is it nobody talks to each other on the trains? Mm-hmm. Like in coming in Chicago, like that, does that make sense? Maybe it does. Maybe talking to strangers sucks. Maybe we're happier keeping to ourselves in all of these places. And I remember I told a senior colleague of mine at Booth, a very well-respected psychologist, I told him that, you know, what I want to do is I want to take our experiments out onto the train. I want to conduct an experiment on the train where we have people actually try to have a conversation with somebody or keep to themselves. And his look of kind of bafflement, just because it's not the kind of thing that psychologists often do, right? We run mm-hmm. very carefully controlled experiments, you know, in the lab, or like we have done with you guys as well. Sometimes, you know, we're not reluctant to get out into the world a little bit, but still getting out onto the trains was an unusual thing. So too, I even have felt that sometimes before my experiments. So one of the more memorable moments I had that's related to Anne's show, was the very first time I ran an experiment with an audience where I had them essentially do what Anne is doing mm-hmm. in the show by having them, I paired them up randomly with another person in the room to have a deep conversation with this person. I put questions up on the board. This was at a hedge fund in Connecticut, actually, for a financial decision-making conference. And I had shown up, I thought, as kind of the light entertainment in the, you know, late morning. I put these questions up on the board that I'm going to have them talk about, these kind of masters of the financial universe sitting there in the audience. Things like, what are you most grateful for in your life? Please tell me about it. Can you tell me about one of the last times you cried in front of another person? And as soon as I put those questions up on the screen, guy in the front row blurts out, ah, shit. I could just feel like all the energy in the room just suddenly draining out. And I have this moment where I'm thinking, oh my gosh, it's such a terrible idea to do. This is going to be a total disaster. And then when I actually got them together to actually talk, first off, none of them really hesitated that much. And then once I started talking, to your point about how this changes the room, you know, in Anne's program, I mean, it just totally changed the character of the place. I mean, it went from kind of being dead and unfriendly to being lively and a lot of laughter going on. The whole tenor of the room changed, and then I couldn't get them to stop talking. So
this is an advantage I have over you, which is when they know the Second City guy is coming in, they're expecting a level of idiocy.
Right.
And they do not. So it's a bait and switch that is happening. Like, I should probably just go in and do a behavioral science lecture as my, you know, pivot.
That's your thing, yeah.
But, you know, but there's been similar situations, which, and usually this is what happens with me, which is the bosses who hired me, well, they're not going to do the exercises. You know how, and I'm like, no. If you're in the room, you're not observing all your people. Like, what a terrible break of trust that would be. And indeed, afterwards, they're some of the first people to come up and be like, what happened? You know, like, and the thing is, you're not asking for a radical thing. You are basically being like, hey, you know the story you tell with your buddies, or you tell at a family barbecue. Mm-hmm. Just do that with the person you work with.
Mm-hmm.
And then the shock really is that we're not doing this all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your book makes it very clear that there are reasons that we are not doing this all the time. So why? Like, well, this is so obvious.
Mistaken reasons. I mean, it is not so obvious at the moment, right? So when you think about reaching out and engaging with somebody else, like talking to a stranger on the train or on the sidewalk or on a plane or out in the world or sharing something meaningful with a coworker or with a random group of strangers, whatever, you are taking what feels like some kind of a risk, right? That is, you have to reach out and do this thing. And part of you wants to do it to connect. You kind of know that maybe this will turn out well. You like engaging with people, but you worry about how the other person's going to respond. And that's really the thing that creates a mistake. We find over and over again is that we tend to underestimate how positively others will respond when we reach out to connect with them. And underestimating then the power that we have to connect with other people is the thing that really keeps us from doing it more often in our lives. This thing that we know is good, we won't do, or if we kind of have some sense is good for us to do, that we need to be connected with other people. We won't do if we think somebody else doesn't want to engage with us in some way, or this won't go over very well, or this kind word that I pass along to somebody won't really matter, or this gratitude that I'm expressing to someone, I won't get the words quite right and it'll fall flat, right? We won't do those things that create meaningful connections in our lives.
I was typing up the notes for this podcast interview. So I read the book, I underline the book, I then go back and do the notes, which is good. This is all part of the learning loop. And occasionally I'll take a break and I popped on Facebook. And I saw that my friend John's mama died. And actually John didn't post it, his wife posted it. And it was in that moment where I realized, had I not been engaging with your words, I would not have done the thing I did, which was easy, which was very easy. Mm-hmm. I sent John an email. I go, hey, just saw this online. Losing a parent sucks. I just want you to know I'm thinking about you, Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
And the note, and I haven't talked to John in 5 years. The note I got back was so lovely. And he's like, oh, he's a musician. He's like, I just wrote some new music here. I also want to share this with you. And I'm like, what I would have missed had I not just taken the beat to do what I did. But the only reason I did is because I was primed from reading your book. And so my question is then, like, how do I keep that pump primed to make that better choice every day?
Yeah. So first off, we find that one experience won't do it. One experience updates your belief for a moment. In more recent research that we published that I actually don't have in the book, I thought experience would calibrate us pretty quickly. And it does. That is, after you have a nice experience like this, you think, oh, I should do that all the time. But then we find that that learning decays pretty quickly. And it's easy to forget the thing you had learned before. So I think the thing that's required, is to, one, potentially leave those reminders around. Like, I try to keep thank you notes around in my desk drawer, right? Places that are close by where I can see them for a case like this to help me remember, right? So that's one thing. Prompts like that can help you to do that. But then the other thing is just practice. It is not, it is not that much different than physical exercise, this kind of social exercise, that eventually your experience does change your mind. I don't feel like I have these kinds of barriers to reaching out and engaging with other people as I once did. I'm not that pessimistic about how others will respond to me, but it's because I've done it a bunch. It's practice, practice, practice. And I would like it to be easier. Like, one nice thing makes it stick. But as with many things, it's something you have to practice. So I suggest taking a small thing, like taking a thing that you can kind of wrap your head around that's concrete and specific, like, when you hear someone is going through a bad time, I will send them an email, right? Mm-hmm. I will send them a note. I will reach out to them, or we'll call them, whatever. Take something small like that and work on that as a habit, because once you make something more of a routine habit, that's when you update your beliefs and do it regularly. Or I'll talk to strangers on the plane, or, you know, I'll use my drive home to call up an old friend when I'm coming home. That's how you do it, is you turn something into a routine habit. And that'll eventually keep it going for you.
A thought I'm having while you're talking is there's been some discussion about these GLP-1 drugs and how amazing they are in terms of helping people with other things in their lives, and not just losing weight, but, you know, maybe getting off alcohol and heart disease and things like that. And one of the scientist who was on this podcast I was listening to had said it might not be that the drug is doing all these things, but that the side effects of losing weight have people walking more, drinking more water.
Interesting. Like,
right? And so then my question becomes, is it my ADHD and my need to get up and go talk to other people because I don't want to do the thing in front of me is the thing? Or was I impelled to be an extrovert and just talk to a bunch of, you know what I'm saying? It's like, is it the thing that is a mistake in one domain that I'm not concentrating enough to finish this task at hand? Also responsible for me being a social creature in the office who connects with everyone?
Oh, that's interesting. That's a good question. Certainly, there are different reasons why we reach out to engage with other people. Procrastination is one. It is not the one that we have focused on per se, but there are often silver linings, even with things that don't serve us well necessarily in one context can in another. What we find consistent, at least one barrier to reaching out, the one that I think we can do something about is the belief that is that we can't do this very well.
Yes.
That we can't connect with other people very well, and hence we don't try. I wouldn't necessarily encourage procrastination as a good way of creating social connection, but I would encourage folks to try to get over some of the mistaken beliefs that we have about that keep us from reaching out more often in our lives.
Well, I'm thinking too about the two or three introverts who work at Second City. I know this is hard to believe that they do, but they do, are all people who feel very comfortable coming to my office because I'm so much in their face. And I want you to talk a little bit about this because I think we understand, at least there's a popular conception now, that extroversion and introversion may be on a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
But your research is very clear in this, that if you simply act like an extrovert, it will, and I'll let you say what the dot on that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think the interesting thing about this, and this is true about a lot of personality traits, individual differences, is that it's easy for us to think that they describe the type of person that we are, like what we like and what we don't like. Extroverts like connecting with other people. They are made happier by connecting with other people. And introverts don't like that in some way. They are made happier by doing other things. But it turns out that, at least when it comes to sociality, extroversion and introversion anyway, that personality trait seems to better describe the type of choices you make than it does the type of experiences you actually have. So back in the 1980s, psychologists started studying well-being and happiness. One of the first questions they asked was how personality is related to happiness and well-being. And you might imagine there's no relationship, right? Because, you know, as somebody who's extroverted, they get what they want. They go out and engage with people. Introverts, they, you know, keep more to themselves and do more quiet sorts of things. And therefore, you know, both are equally happy because they're doing their own thing. That just wasn't in the data. What the data showed was that there's a strong correlation between extroversion and well-being, that folks who are more extroverted, more outgoing, more assertive, they tend to be happier than those who are not, have more positive affect in their lives than those who are more introverted. And the correlation isn't small, it's big. When it comes to like happiness or positive mood, the correlation is about 0.5, which is as big as the correlation between the heights of fathers and sons. Satisfaction with life, how satisfied with your life in general you are, is a little weaker in the ballpark of 0.3, a little smaller correlation, but they're positive. So it's not zero, it's positive. That then led psychologists to wonder, well, maybe this difference comes from different kinds of activities that they engage in, that extroverts just do things that make them happier than introverts do. And that turns out to be right. That raised the question of, well, maybe asking people to act extroverted would make people feel more positive in a half hour lab experiment or in an hour or over the course of a day or over the course of 2 weeks, as Sonia Lubomirsky, psychologist at UC Riverside, studies. And it was almost heretical to ask that question. Like, if you think of personality as the type of person you are, then changing the type of person you are doesn't make sense. But if you think of it as the type of choices you make, and that maybe extroverts are just choosing to do different things than introverts, then it does make sense to think about this as a potential intervention, in the same way that, you know, exercising is a type of choice we make, and changing those choices could make us healthier. And indeed, what psychologists found was that when you asked people to act more extroverted, positive mood went up basically across the board in general, regardless of how extroverted you report being on a personality scale, right? And I think this highlights a really, really important feature of our work and really how I've come to understand sociality and social connection and personality too. And is that social connection isn't something that just happens to us. Social connection is a choice to some extent. It's a choice that we make in the moments of our lives, right? when we choose to smile at someone or make eye contact or say hello or have that more meaningful conversation with somebody or have that hard conversation we need to have someone or reach out and express gratitude or tell someone who just lost their mom that there's nothing I can do, but that really sucks and I love you. Mm. Or we hold back and we don't do that. That's a choice, right? And those choices can come to look like the type of person we are if we make those choices routinely, right? Those choices become our character. They become who we are, but you can choose differently, right? I interviewed Jessica Pan for the book. Jessica Pan is a journalist in the UK who I love. I've become friends with. She reached out after I published my first book, Mindwise. She was about to embark on a year's worth of experiments, be acting more extroverted in her life, just to see how that would make, and she called, see how that would make her feel. She called me up before she was going to do this, actually in the office where I am now. She called me up and in a panic about how, you know, being an introvert was, she was going to ruin her life by doing this over the course of a year. And it just turned out that wasn't true, that choosing to reach out a little bit more often when you could and you felt safe and comfortable to do it was revelatory for her. Fundamentally changed the choices that she made and therefore the kinds of behavior she engaged in and therefore the type of person she was. And one of my prized possessions is a copy of her fabulous first book, which is titled Sorry I'm Late, I Didn't Want to Come, that says, Nick, thank you so much for changing my life and that of many others. And when you recognize that social connection is a choice in the same way that exercising, physical exercise is a choice, it just changes the way you think about how you can live your life. And nothing has changed the way I live my life more than this. It's very powerful insight.
There's two other characters that you highlight in the book and for our audience, Daryl Davis, who was a guest on the podcast maybe 3 weeks ago. And
amazing guy. Did the
very unlikely thing of being a black man who reached out to KKK members. And next week's podcast, which is with Zha Zhang,
Is that right?
Yes, we did rejection therapy. It's such a small world.
Awesome.
And even more so, I'm reading Dana Suskin's new book, which is called Human Raised, Nurturing Connection, Curiosity, and Lifelong Learning in the Age of AI. Dana's at the University of Chicago, married to a colleague.
Yep.
And she has a line in the book that I just said to Anne when she was in my office that I just love, which I think relates to what we're talking about, which is, and she's quoting another child development psychologist who says, the best toy for a child is 90% child, 10% toy.
Mm, yeah.
And that is this focus in a world of AI. What and this is what we talk a lot about at Second City, because in improvisation, we're all about the mistakes. The errors are opportunities. The obstacles are gifts. And AI doesn't know how to play with the errors. That's not a thing. It's looking for predictive
patterns. It doesn't. Yes, and Kelly.
No, it doesn't. unless that yes and is leading to an outcome, it is predictive.
Yeah.
And as we know, it's like this is it's not.
Right.
And I think what's so, and another thing that's interesting in the book is when you talk about laughter, and Anne's last book came out last fall, and she makes a big distinction in the book to say, look, I'm writing this book called Funnier, which is a comedy theory book for people who professionally make comedy. But what you need to understand is the bulk of laughter in your life is not coming out of professionally made comedy.
Right, right. Yeah. So some of the most amazing, some of the most interesting, amazing work that I've come across in my decades as a behavioral scientist is the work of the late, great Robert Provine, who discovered that laughter is not about, as much as you would imagine, is not as much about in daily life what is said as the context in which something is said. So he found that mostly when people were laughing in their daily lives, he did these studies that I'm sure his colleagues thought were batshit crazy too, which was, I'm just going to go out on the sidewalk and see when people laugh and find out what are they laughing about? And the answer was, not very much. And this would be totally depressing if you're a comic, or I would think if you're in the business of this, that They weren't laughing at things that were funny. They were laughing because there were other people around. And what Provine learned, which you see every night at Second City when people come as a crowd to watch your show among friends and people who become friends, is that that laughter is a social signal. It's a signal that I like you and I'm kind of wanting to connect with you. We laugh around other people. In fact, Provine said the only necessary feature for laughter, the only necessary ingredient for laughter is other people. Mm-hmm. He found people just don't very often laugh by themselves. That doesn't happen that often. Overwhelmingly, we laugh when other people are around because laughter is a social signal that connects us with other people.
The quote that people attribute to Groucho Marx and others, and we don't know who said it, was the shortest distance between two people is a laugh.
Interesting.
And I love that. I want to talk about the chapter 7, which is choosing thankfulness. And I'll start with this, which is, you said to me some afternoon up on campus, hey, if you're in a bad mood and you want to get out of it, do something nice for someone. And I've never forgotten it. And it has been true 1,000% of the time.
Is that right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the self-help literature gets this often wrong. The self-help industry encouraged us to turn inward, to look at ourselves, to be kind to ourselves, to treat ourselves in some way. And certainly there are ways in which that can be uplifting and feel good for a moment. But the data from the behavioral science is crystal clear that if you want a positive reaction, a feeling that lasts a little bit, because it also changes your sense of who you are a little bit, and it also presses on the identity that most of us want to have of ourselves, which is that we're decent people, is that the better recipe for having a good day is figuring out how to make somebody else's day. And that tends to last because for a few reasons why kindness generally feels good, being kind to other people. One is that it connects us with other people. So when you do something kind for someone, if you just pass along a kind word to someone, right? Or you laugh with someone for a moment, it bonds you to that person. And we are fundamentally social creatures with a brain equipped to tell us it's a good thing to be connected to other people. That tends to feel pretty good. So that relational connection is a fundamental need that's satisfied. Second, when we do something kind for somebody else, usually it works. Not always. Mm-hmm. You might, pass along a compliment to somebody and they will say, those words are terrible and not even the correct grammar. But that's almost never happens, like vanishingly rarely does something like that happen. Usually when you're kind to somebody, it works. And so you then feel competent and capable. And then third, when you go out and do something kind for somebody else, you're the one who did it. And that autonomy, that feeling that I've been responsible for this good thing also feels good. So kindness really kind of hits all of the buttons that we need for feeling good about ourselves. And the additional benefit is that we find it leaves the other person feeling even better. Mm-hmm. So you have a surprising amount of power to lift people up if you choose to use it. And it's not something that has to be self-sacrificing. The great thing about this is, unlike exercise, which sucks, it's hard and it's tiring and doesn't feel good while you're doing it, being kind to other people feels pretty darn good while you're doing it and makes the other person feel even better.
So I want to double click on something that was a thought I had. Things like gratitude, self-disclosure, kindness could all seem very soft. However, I'm looking at the cover of Dana's book, Who Lost Her Husband. You and I have both lost children. This stuff saved me. I can't even tell you how much. Like, it saved me in that experience. Because for a number of reasons, and it continues to. The self-disclosure, both during the process in terms of just signaling to people, like, I might need your help. In terms of navigating this stuff, it is the gratitude for what you do have, especially when it's not there. So in the messiest, darkest, hardest moments, this was the most important stuff. And you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is not soft and it's not easy and it's also not small. So sometimes when I tell folks about our work, they'll think it's talking to strangers and it's light and it's kind of momentary. And some of that is true, but that is in the sense that these reaching out to connect with other people is a kind of lighthearted thing that sometimes we can do. But that need or that desire to reach out and engage with somebody else affects us not just in small things, moment to moment, do I smile and say hello, but also in the really big moments of our lives, mm-hmm. like some of the hardest moments of our lives. So, we lost a baby 6 months into my wife's pregnancy, which you are already referred to. We lost our daughter, Sophie. She had Down syndrome. And for us, we sat with that for a long time, about a year, without knowing what really to do. And here is then a moment where my research really spoke to me very personally. Was I went and I remember one morning my wife was sitting in our sunroom. We got two chairs in there. She was having a cup of coffee that morning. We're just kind of in a funk. You better than anyone knows what that funk is like. And I told my wife that, you know, we had adopted before. We'd adopted two children by that point. We had four kids at that time. And I said, we could do this again if you were up for it. There are kids that need parents. We were ready to go. And we had that taken from us. We can do this again. We're ready to go. Would you be open for that? And she, without missing a beat, she said, would you be open to adopting a child with Down syndrome? The daughter we had lost had Down syndrome. And we were ready to go with that. And all of that, all that was entailed in raising a child with an intellectual disability. My mind actually wasn't there at that moment. Like, it was not what I had in mind. Mm-hmm. And I was, all of the kind of anxiety that I had, the avoidance oriented, oh, it's going to be a scary, bad thing. How are we going to connect with this child? How's she going to connect with us? All of that stuff came right back to me like it did when we first got the diagnosis for Sophie at 3 months. And then I remember just having this crystal clear feeling that, like, I'm a person in my experiment. I'm one of the people in these studies who's got an opportunity to reach out and engage with somebody else. My wife and I have a very strong marriage. We have resources to be able to do this. We were ready to go with this. So we're in a different position than other families might be. But I realized, like, I'm a person in my experiment here who's feeling this anxiety about reaching out and welcoming a child into our lives. And that gave me some courage to make a different choice in that moment, to say, yes, honey, we can do this together. And so it's not, our work about being overly reluctant to reach out and engage with other people isn't just to make light moments better or kind of boring moments better. But we find it in the hardest moments too. Like, when you need support and you need help, other people are more willing to help you than you'd think. You have certainly found that out. I have found that out when I've reached out to people in hard moments. Our daughter, Sion, and we saw you and Anne in the elevator one time at Lurie's when you were visiting Nora. Our daughter went through ovarian cancer at about that same time. And we reached out to people who helped us beyond what we could have imagined. Lauren Silich, who's works at owned the Chick-fil-A down the street from Lurie Children's Hospital. I reached out to her when Sion was in the hospital. And I said, hey, this is what I knew her because she had reached out to me before. This is where we are. I just thought I would reach out. Is there anything that you could do to lift Sion's spirits at this moment? She asked, how many nurses are on the floor?
Love it.
Right? How many nurses are on the floor? And pretty soon there are bags of Chick-fil-A sandwiches and waffle fries and lemonade showing up on the floor. Like, you know, standard deviations beyond what I would have imagined was possible. This stuff shows up in the hard moments we have in our relationships where, you know, I've been married 30 years as of this year, Jen and I. Kelly, you're going on a long marriage with Anne as well.
30 as well.
Is that right? 30 this year too? How about that? Yeah. We're in sync. There are hard moments where you got to have hard conversations, right? And you're nervous about having that conversation. But when you actually have them, they tend to go better than you think they will, right? Mm-hmm. We find in our work. And those are the kinds of conversations you have to have in order to keep relationships strong over a long period. Relationship researchers have found it's not whether you fight that really defines whether you're in a good relationship or not. It's how you do it. When you actually are open and honest, things tend to go much better. So 100% agree with that insight that it's not just the kind of light moments that are made better when you reach out, but it's really the darker moments, the harder moments, the difficult things where I think our mistaken beliefs about how other people will respond can be particularly problematic. Keep us from reaching out when we could. Keep us from reaching out to people like your friend who just lost his mother to people when they really need someone else's support.
Yeah. I was just at Lurie like 3 weeks ago. One of our friends from the palliative care asked if I would do some nurse training and sort of explain our experience. And so I got, and I'm in the hallway and I ran into our oncologist, Jen, and big hugs. And she's like, do you want to come to my office? Fair warning, your daughter's picture is in my office. And I'm like, and that was actually love. I love that. And then one of our nurses was like, do I hear Kelly Leonard's here? And runs out, big hug. And it wasn't that the conversation wasn't hard. It wasn't that there weren't tears.
Yeah.
There were, of course.
Yeah.
But there was so much more going on in that moment. And one of the things that you just referred to, which, and this was the hardest part of the book for me in some regard, was the stuff around honesty. Cause like we had Leslie John on the pod, who you probably know.
Yep.
And her book Revealing.
Yeah.
And there's stuff in there where I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. Are you like, really? You'd make that choice, like the honest choice. And just as I experienced in talking to her, when I was reading that section in your book, I did come away with being like, you know what? Almost every single choice, I think I would want the honest choice, even if that was going to be painful. And I, to me, my body fights that the hardest.
Yeah.
Of anything we're talking about.
I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that too. Because what we find in our work that people miss about honesty is that, and this is a perspective gap that shows up in lots of different places. We tend to focus on our competency. So we're focused on what we're saying, how we're saying it, what's coming across, the content. Like if we're, you know, if I'm trying to pass along a joke, I'm not thinking about, I'm thinking about what are the words that I'm saying. If I'm writing a gratitude letter, I'm focused on that. If I'm saying something to you, giving you feedback, I'm thinking about the words. Other people tend to interpret us in terms of our warmth, right? Are you kind? Are you decent? Are you honest? Honesty is a warmth trait, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we're not paying attention to when we're communicating. So it's not that the content of what we say doesn't matter. It does. Or that it's not hard. It does. Or it can be. Or that the honest feedback that's negative can hurt. It can. But what we miss is what the behavior also reveals to the other person. And this is part of Leslie John's insight as well, is that when you reveal something to somebody else that's honest, when you are honest with them, it is telling them, at least when you have good intent, not just when you're being cruel, but when you have good intent, it's also revealing to them that you care for them. Mm. Right? Who is it that tells you your fly is unzipped, right? When you're on stage, it's your friends who tell you that, right? Yeah. It's the people who really care for you, who give you that, who are honest with you, right? And that's the part that's easy for us to miss. When you are honest with someone, it's also communicating to them that I care about you, right? That can be easy to miss.
You talk about Michael Sleepian, who's a colleague of yours, and he has a line, quote, secrets usually hurt their holder most,
yeah,
end quote. And then he experienced this personally.
Yeah. Yeah. So what Sleepian meant by that is, and so Michael Sleepian's a psychologist at Columbia University, who's got this amazing, line of research on secrecy. Has got a great book on the topic as well. And interestingly, what he has learned is that the thing that hurts about secrets isn't what you might imagine, isn't what many of us thought would be, which is the act of trying to hide something, right? And the act of lying and stuff. That's not actually what it is. What he found about secrecy that hurts people, that creates a burden, is that it isolates you from other people. Mm. Because you have this thing that you feel like you cannot share with somebody else, that keeps you from passing it along. And that makes you feel lonely. It induces loneliness. Secrecy is lonely. And that's the way in which it hurts the holder the most. We find that when we actually ask people to reveal something negative about themselves, something that they've been keeping secret, they actually are not judged as harshly by the other person as they think they will. Right? So there's a mistake that we make. The thing that keeps us from revealing this, oh, this other person is going to think so poorly of me, or they're going to hate me for this, or whatever. We're just off about that a little bit, right? They just don't care that much. It's not that problematic for them. And the fact that you are revealing it to them also is showing that you care about them, that you're being honest with them. And so to me, that misplaced secrecy, like many of the mistakes that we make in our social lives, to the extent that it comes from a mistake, isn't just unfortunate, it's almost tragic, right? That we're choosing to keep ourselves isolated with secrets that nobody would mind if we shared with them. Or we're choosing to keep ourselves isolated on the trains in Chicago when we'd be happy connecting with our neighbors. Or we're not engaging with folks on planes. I just came back from Aspen, Colorado, where I was speaking last week. I sat next to a young man who had this crazy, awesome hair, made me totally jealous of him. And I had the most amazing conversation with him. Turns out he was adopted as well and was actually the child of an assault, right? Hmm. And to have connected with someone who's lived, you know, like that, who revealed something that meaningful and deep to me, you know, on a 2-hour plane ride, that was really, really powerful. And to think how easy it is to miss those things, right?
Yeah.
And how impoverished your life could be otherwise. It feels tragic to the extent that we're missing those based on mistakes.
It's funny that it's making me think of an insight I think I had when we were first starting working together, which is there is this weird kinship between comedians and behavioral scientists, which is both are observing the world to actually see what's the truth in a moment.
Yeah, right.
And we're using
different methods, but experimenting.
It is experimenting. Yeah, yeah. We're using it, and it ends up. And I think in many ways it can end up doing similar things. There's sure. So many truths from 30 Rock or the Colbert Report or wherever that you're like, oh my God, this is something just like I get from reading the books. Before I ask you the last question, which is going to be for a thank you because story, I do. You and the advent calendar experiment you did with your family. I had such like, oh my God, I did that with my kids so many times.
Is that right?
Like not that specific thing, but like screwing with a family tradition to satisfy some professional.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Yes. It's always like, are you really making me yes and this thing? Like, is that what we're going to do in the house
over dinner now? Yeah.
Yeah. So explain how you potentially ruined Christmas.
At least for a moment I did. Yeah. So, I remember one year, this was during COVID actually, that we did this, the first time where, we just published a paper actually on how surprisingly uplifting kind words and compliments are to other people. And I thought that, you know, a good way to practice this around the holiday time for us would be to change the typical Advent calendars that we do, which is a kid growing up in the Midwest in a Lutheran church. We did every December where you'd get a box of, you know, like a poster sort of thing, but there was a box and there were doors for each day of December leading up to Christmas. And you'd open each one and there was chocolate in behind it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Instead of doing that self-interested thing, eating chocolate, I made it social and I asked the kids so I printed out sheets of paper that had like a partial sentence on it. I love you because, or I like it when you this, or my favorite part about you is this, or I remember when, and they had to write 5 different compliments for each person in the family and summed up across, or 4 rather we did. And there were 6 of us who were participating. So that worked out to be 24 for us. It was perfect. And then I took those slips of paper, cut them up, wound them over each other and stapled them into a ring. And then I just created this ring of compliments. So instead of opening, each day and getting chocolate, we got opened up and got a compliment from a family member. And I remember very clearly the kids They all like to. Exactly, right? They were all participants in our experiments.
Yeah.
And yet, it really was powerful. Every day, that whole month was just better.
Yeah.
It was just better. Sure. You could feel that the mood, I mean, they all came downstairs in the morning having just opened this lovely little thing from somebody else. And the kids joked with each other some, so that was kind of funny too. But I've kept a bunch of those. I got them sitting under my computer in my at my home office. And it was powerful. I have not been able to get all of them together to do that too many years in a row as they move on and that gets more complicated. But it was powerful when we were able to do it.
I love it. So the Thank You Because story that I'm going to ask for you comes out of our collaboration. And it was the way I tell it, and Anne says I'm making this up, but it's good for keynote speeches, we led you guys through a yes and, the yes and exercise. I think it was asked, like, just lead us through, like, your, this is right at the beginning, through a popular exercise. And immediately you're sort of like, well, there actually is already research that exists that would support the yes and idea. Ideas of abundance, ideas in behavioral economics about people's default position to say no or do nothing. And then the question was asked, well, you know, how do you stay inside a difficult conversation that you do not want to yes and, which is feedback we get all the time from clients, but we had not come up with the solution. And the idea that we ran a bunch with our friend and colleague Heather Caruso, and Juan, that was this idea of if you express gratitude, and this is the thank you, you're not going to put someone in a defensive position. And then the because is like finding a thing that you value in what they just said, even minor. And when we ran it with, you know, both parties doing it, it was very successful. And then we wanted to do it with just one party doing it. Also pretty darn successful.
Yeah.
Has been a thing I've used time and time again. Again, it's hard.
Yeah.
You don't want to do it. And the big example Anne always uses when she talks about is that you guys would all do it to each other at a certain point when you'd be arguing about something as a way to like, okay, let's try this. So I'm just sort of curious if there's a thank you because story that resonates with you in your time.
So the one that's coming to me right now, actually, because we're in Chicago, and this is in a moment of conflict where maybe you didn't want to have this conversation, was a moment. I didn't use these words exactly, but it was actually a moment at the end of my driveway. I write about this in the book. Mm-hmm. Here in Wisconsin, it was during COVID, we had some campaign signs for Joe Biden run over across the road, and I just called up the sheriff to say that you just want to know about this. And so he said, I'm just up the road. I'm going to come down. Just see what you're talking about. I'm only a mile away. So we came down, we meet at the end of the driveway there. And he comes over, we show him the spot and then we start talking for a little bit. And eventually he turns to me and he says, he tells me, for instance, that these are the first Biden signs that he'd seen vandalized. All the ones that were getting vandalized were Trump signs, which I was surprised by.
Yep.
And then he asked me, so what is it about Trump you don't like? Right? And these are the conversations that we typically don't have. This guy's got a full, armored vest on and a sidearm and an AR-15 sitting in the back of his car at the end of the driveway, right? But he was willing to ask that question, right? And so the thank you because moment there was, thank you for asking me that question because it got us to talk about something we would have talked about before. Mm-hmm. And that ended up being like the best conversation about politics that I've had still in many years because, he was open. He wanted to hear about somebody else's perspective on this. He said, you're a university professor. I'd love to hear what your perspective on this is. I was thankful to him because he's a police officer working in the shortly after the George Floyd protests, and he could tell me what it was like to be a police officer at that moment. He was telling me how hard it was to do this job that he thought he loved because he worried people were so suspicious and distrusting of him now that made it very hard to do this job that he always thought was so important and valuable. And that was a conversation I will never forget. That one will always stick with me. And the thank you because moment there was from him being able to ask me a question that nobody else usually would anymore.
Yeah, that's right. We've been working with the University of Chicago Crime Lab now for a couple of years, and these are not people who vote like I vote. These are not people who experience the world necessarily in the way I experience it. And after this 3-hour session, we got each other's backs.
Yeah.
There's just, I mean, like the differences are so far outweighed by the similarities. Yes. And we did that work together is the other thing, which is the same thing that you did.
Yeah.
The book is called A Little More Social, How Small Choices Create Unexpected Happiness, Health, and Connection. Nick Epley, so great talking to you.
Thank you, Kelly. It was great being here with you again.
Getting the S&D is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.